Please join
an attitude of meditation and prayer. This universe, our world, from its foundations to its most glorious creations, is divided into complementary opposites, positive and negative, light and dark, hot and cold, male and female. Consider for a moment all the things that give life its joy and meaning, and consider how so very many stem from the basic division of life into male and female. Consider, for instance, that without male and female, there would not be a single flower in the world, not a single one. Beauty, hope, desire, love, meaning, identity, our very futures, all these things and so much more come to us through the filter of male and female, positive and negative, light and dark, hot and cold. Now try to imagine life without gender, without the differences, without the complementary yet distinct male and female life forces, without the drives, desires, needs, and wants that so mold our lives and our destinies. Try to imagine how radically different life would be without this most fundamental division between male and female. And then wonder, what would become of love? What would become of us? Well, it's nice to be here again. I really enjoy the privilege I have of coming up here from time to time and speaking to you. A couple of years ago, I did a sermon on death, and today I'm talking about love. And appropriately, here on April 15th, it occurs to me that now all I need to do is figure out a way to write a sermon about taxes, and I'll be done. Now, I wish I could take credit for the title of this sermon, but I can't. The title comes from an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a show that I like so much that I did a service on it a couple of years ago. What's going on is that Buffy is in love with someone and is complaining that he is acting all jealous but won't admit it. Buffy is talking to her friend Willow, and when Buffy complains to Willow that her boyfriend is being totally irrational, Willow says, "Love makes you do the wacky," to which Buffy responds, "That's the truth." Now, I agree with Buffy. Love does make you do the wacky. I'll bet everybody in the sanctuary has at least one story of wacky behavior caused by being in love, which begs the question, why? Why does love make us do the wacky? Why do we risk our jobs, our friends, our futures, our very lives in the name of love? What is it about romantic love that not only does it have its own holiday, but it provides both the greatest joys and the worst agonies imaginable? Because truly, what can be better or worse than the total agony of being in love? Now, I was looking for a definition of love, and I found several that I want to share with you. The first is simple. It is that love is the type of insanity curable by marriage. You laugh now, but file this one away for later. And how about this one? It's from a conference of sociologists back in 1977. You'll have to listen carefully. Love is the cognitive affective state characterized by intrusive and obsessive fantasizing concerning reciprocity of amorant feeling by the object of the amorants. Now, I dare anyone to try to turn that into a poem. In fact, I'm not sure I'd feel comfortable with the person who came up with that thing dating my daughter. Now, there are, of course, long dictionary definitions, but I think part of the problem in defining love is that in our culture, love is required to be all things to all people all of the time. Think about it. We love our spouse or our partner, certainly. But we also love our cars, our kids, our favorite colors, our jokes, our art, our sports teams, and on and on. The word love has as many meanings and covers as much ground as the word God. Eskimos have 20 words for snow, and we have one word for love. At least the Greeks had four words for love. There was eros, or romantic love, agape, or spiritual love, philia, or platonic love, and storge, which is natural affection like that of a parent to a child. But we English-speaking people with a language that has the biggest vocabulary of all the languages, we have only one word for love. Why is that? I think part of it is that our culture is very schizophrenic about love, and there are enormous sensitivities around it, especially romantic love. For example, you may have heard of the late Leo Boscalia, who once taught a course on love at UCLA called Love 1A, and who wrote many books on the subject. Dr. Boscalia taught that love is something we need to learn about, and that understanding and dealing with love isn't something that comes to us by osmosis. As a matter of social and cultural behavior, I think we can all agree with Dr. Boscalia. But as you might imagine, Dr. Boscalia's course created some controversy as people complained that university is no place to teach about love. Seriously, university should be reserved for important stuff like history, language, science, and engineering. Besides, love is a delicate subject, one that should be kept in a brown paper wrapper and only spoken about in hushed whispers behind closed doors or on the streets or under the covers. Now, I don't know about you, but I think all that is just ridiculous. I agree with, of all people, Benjamin Disraeli, who said, quote, "We are all born to love. It is the principle of existence and its only end," unquote. Now, I think Disraeli was right on at least two counts. First, as I'll explain in a minute, we are born to love. The mechanisms of romantic love are hardwired, and we are bound to that drive, those desires, like nothing else in life except perhaps eating and drinking. And second, I believe that romantic love, sex, and reproduction are the very purpose of our natural existence, the focus of life, and the only inherently meaningful thing about life beyond its simple being. I have a book called Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice for All Creation by the evolutionary biologist Olivia Judson. I was going to bring it here today to show it to you, but I lent it to somebody. It is a very clever book, written as if Dr. Tatiana was answering letters about sex, reproduction, and other related issues from a variety of the members of the animal kingdom. Talk about wacky. I'm telling you, insect reproduction in particular is bizarre and often deadly. Males in several species literally die for the opportunity to mate and pass on their genes. If life on this planet is in fact the design of some intelligent creator, then he or she was on serious drugs when they came up with the myriad methods of sexual reproduction extant in the animal kingdom. If you want to get educated and blown away at the same time, I suggest you read Dr. Tatiana. Now, insects don't have the capacity for rational thought, at least we don't think they do, and their behavior is thus controlled by their genetic code that is hardwired into their very being. How else can you explain the sometimes suicidal and often dangerous behavior indulged in by a whole host of critters in the animal kingdom? For a long time, people believed that humans were immune to that sort of hardwiring, that our big brains removed us from the ranks of creatures who were programmed for certain responses and behaviors in the world of romantic love, sex, and reproduction. However, it is becoming crystal clear that we were very wrong about that. Very, very wrong indeed. Study after study has shown that desire and what we call romantic love is the result of chemical processes in the brain that are not only hardwired, but result in brain activity that is virtually indistinguishable from being on hard drugs, and in particular drugs like cocaine. Now think about that for a second. Being head over heels in love results from or in, take your pick, brain activity that is indistinguishable from being on hard drugs. Is it any wonder that people routinely behave insanely when they are in that stomach-wrenching, sleep-deprived, dramatic phase of love? The poets who wrote about love didn't know the half of it. So it turns out that the brain is, in fact, the most important organ related to love, sex, and reproduction. At every turn, genetic programs working through the brain guide humans in their dances of love. And I know it's not exactly politically correct to say this, but the scientific truth is that men's and women's brains are significantly different in the programs that they run, the systems they create, and the desires that they generate. This is true about almost every aspect of romantic love and reproduction, including sexual orientation, desire, and how the sexes view their roles in the courtship dance. And the most recent studies show that socio-cultural influences are far less important on these very fundamentally hardwired programs than anybody had suspected. Here are a few specific, and I hope amusing, results for you to ponder. In a study of the effects of pictures of beautiful women on the brains of men, researchers found that the pictures activated the same reward circuits in the brains of heterosexual men as did food and cocaine. Here is proof, as if we needed it, that men truly are visually stimulated. As co-author of the study, Dan Arelli of MIT said, quote, "This is hardcore circuitry. Beauty is working similar to a drug," unquote. Another study showed men a slideshow of random women, each being projected for several seconds. But the men could extend the viewing time for each picture by pressing keys on a keypad. And I think you can guess the result. The men worked frantically to keep the beautiful women on the screen, on average pressing the keyboard more than 4,700 times over a 40-minute span, prompting one researcher to observe, quote, "These guys look like rodents bar pressing for cocaine." Now, as far as women are concerned, studies have demonstrated, for instance, that a woman's choice of which men she says she finds sexy changes depending on how close she is to ovulation. When she's close to ovulation, women tend to prefer the almost stereotypical tall, dark, rough-hewn guys, while selecting more round-faced, nice guys at other times. I'm not going to go there. It also turns out that women are thousands of times more sensitive to musk-like odors than are men, which makes perfect sense when you think about it. Now, when it comes to the study of romantic love, there is one person who stands out beyond all the rest. She is Helen Fisher of Rutgers University in New Jersey. Yes, the one with the now famous women's basketball team. And Dr. Fisher is a leader among the army of scientists who are studying the biological bases for romantic love. Dr. Fisher has proposed that human beings fall in love in three stages. Stage one consists of simple and generic lust, that undifferentiated general sense of desire. Studies show that lust is mediated in the brain by the hormones testosterone and estrogen, with testosterone having been shown to play a large role in women. These hormones appear to function to get people out looking, so to speak. The second stage is attraction to a specific person. This is that truly love-struck phase where each instant apart is a lifetime, where you call each other 20 times a day, and where you can't eat, sleep, and can think of nothing else. In the attraction phase, a group of neurotransmitters called monoamines play an important role. These include dopamine, adrenaline, which is the hormone of flight, and serotonin, which plays a role both in romantic love and depression. Big surprise there, right? Now, dopamine is the reward hormone, and its production is what we are after when we desperately need to be with our beloved. It's also the hormone that is made in bucket loads when our brains are exposed to cocaine. Serotonin is the tricky one here, because it can actually induce temporary insanity. Thus, many of the millions of people who do crazy things for love, who swim across rivers naked, who jump out of airplanes with their friends to hold up gigantic signs of proposal while they parachute into the lover's backyard, and all the other stuff you've ever heard of, many of those people actually do qualify as temporarily insane. Now, the third phase of Dr. Fisher's scheme is called attachment, and it involves becoming bonded with and attached to a specific person. It is marked by the sense of calm, peace, and stability that one finds in a long-term partner and is driven by the hormones oxytocin and vasopressin. Crazily enough, oxytocin and vasopressin seem to interfere with the production of dopamine and adrenaline, which is why the madness of the head-over-heels attraction phase fades as the attachment phase progresses, a finding that actually provides a basis for the otherwise cynical definition of love I quoted to you earlier and that you laughed at. In fact, Studies show that it is the hormone vasopressin that is responsible for monogamy in a critter called the prairie vol. Once vasopressin is triggered in the brain of the prairie vol, that vol is faithful to its mate for life. Block the vasopressin, and the very same vol becomes promiscuous. These are very powerful chemicals. Things are obviously much more complicated in human beings. History teaches us that vasopressin does not work nearly as well with people as it does in the prairie vols. But Dr. Fisher nonetheless cautions that you should never mess around with somebody you do not want to fall in love with, because if you generate enough oxytocin and vasopressin, you very well might fall in love despite yourself. Now, as a result of her studies and other studies, Dr. Fisher has drawn the remarkable conclusion that romantic love is not actually an emotion like joy or sadness. Instead, she claims that it is a motivation system, a drive, a need that compels people to go out and find a partner, and is more akin to the need to eat than simply being happy or sad. Romantic love, the attraction phase, says Dr. Fisher, is an even stronger desire than simple lust. Quote, "People don't kill themselves just because they don't get sex," she says, "but they will and do kill themselves over failed romantic love adventures." There is so much more going on in evolutionary biology today, but I don't have the time to go into even a fraction of it. What I will say is that the discoveries of how deeply hardwired we are for lust, attraction, romantic love, and attachment are not a surprise to me. Put simply, reproduction is much too important to leave to the whims of consciousness and culture. And it makes sense that human beings would be subject to the same forces as other animals, since we all share common ancestors and evolved together on this planet. Said another way, before there was consciousness, there was reproduction and all the drives and hard wiring that nature provided to ensure the continuation of life. For the last handful of millennia, perhaps, humans have been able to cogitate about love and sex and reproduction. But a million years ago, those things just had to happen for the species to continue. And nature had to ensure that it would by hardwiring in the proper mechanisms. Science has and continues to confirm that we have inherited those mechanisms, and we call them romantic love. My point in telling you all this is not to pretend to be able to fully explain why or how we fall in love or even the biological basis for romantic love. It is much more complicated than what I've said, of course. My point is to simply suggest to you that there is, in fact, a powerful biological basis for romantic love, that it matters, and that we should openly and fearlessly take account of it in our lives. But these revelations do not sit well with many people who bristle at the thought that humans might be subject to instincts, hardwired mechanisms, and that something as sacred in our culture as romantic love and all the trappings of courtship, marriage, and the like that go with it might be the product of brain chemicals that mimic the action of drugs. As unsettling as the scientific discoveries may be, I think the truth is that we humans are a natural part of the natural world and are certainly a product of evolutionary biology. But we are also conscious beings with the ability to make choices that either complement or reject the signals, motivations, and desires that our DNA has made part of our experiences of life. This is why I think it is useful to think of ourselves as both a what and a who. The what is the creature that Mother Nature created out of the raw materials of life, and which is subject to the same laws, the same forces, and the same desires as any other higher level creature on the planet. The who is a relatively new entity, a conscious being who seemingly, at least, can make choices about how to proceed with existence, and at present seems a little bit confused about what life, the universe, and everything is supposed to mean. These two aspects of our humanity coexist in one body, and both matter. This is also the reason I think that people are often confused when they ask the question, what is the meaning of life? Life is a process that goes on all around us, has been going on for millions upon millions of years. Humans are included in the process of life, but so is the snail darter, or an elephant, or a wasp. So when we think of life in the broadest sense, it is clear that the purpose and meaning of life is survival, reproduction, and all that goes with it. But when they ask the question, what is the meaning of life, many people use the word life to substitute for consciousness and sentience. And that, as they say, is a very different question, and it is one that I don't have any desire to tackle today. Well, all right, I'll say this. Whatever purpose or meaning there is to human existence, as opposed to life generally, it has to be created, invented, as it were, which is the role of culture, religion, and other philosophical enterprises that seek to imbue our sentient existence with meaning. But the meaning of life itself, the purpose of life, that is clear. It is to survive today, tomorrow, and always. Up until 30 or 50 years ago, most educated people saw a human baby as a tabula rasa, a clean slate upon which anything could be written without the pesky influences of instincts or other hardwired instructions or desires. The tabula rasa position denied the existence of, or at least the importance of, hardwiring in humans, and insisted instead that everything we are, believe, feel, and imagine was the result of nurture, culture, and learned phenomenon. Virtually nobody who studies these things today thinks of a baby as a tabula rasa. The concept has been relegated to the same graveyard as phlogiston and the ether. Having said that, I must emphasize that just how much has been pre-programmed or hardwired and how powerfully is subject to debate, some of it very fierce. Still, it is clear that we are born with hardwired drives, call them instincts, call them predispositions, call them an inborn style, but they are there. And probably the most powerful, the one that dominates so much of our lives, is the need for romantic love. Like every other creature on the planet, human beings modify their behaviors to accommodate those incredibly powerful desires, or as Willow says, we all do the wacky. Can these drives and desires be overcome by the who that we are, our conscious selves? Of course they can. People routinely choose to do behaviors that conflict with the urges and desires brought about by romantic love and its chemical addictions to a person. It happens all the time. It's one of the things that distinguish us from insects and the rest of the world. A praying mantis will go ahead and get its head bitten off in exchange for the opportunity to mate. However, even the most testosterone and dopamine-driven man is likely to decline the offer. But does the fact that we can control our behaviors mean we should not acknowledge the drives and desires that are making our lives both wonderful and miserable? Shall we pretend we have conscious control over who and what gender we find attractive, and that any feelings we experience that are not sanctioned by the dominant culture are to be labeled as sinful or wrong? My answer is an emphatic no. I think that it is time we looked at these feelings, these desires, without embarrassment, without shame, without feeling defensive that we are, after all, a product of evolution and are children of the earth as much as children of our conscious souls. While the idea that romantic love is a hardwired mechanism might spoil some of our notions of romance, it is also liberating. I would suggest that if people would let go of the notion of the tabula rasa, would let go of the notion that falling down the rabbit hole of romantic love is a conscious choice, and realize that all those powerful feelings and urges are perfectly natural and are deeply embedded into the essence of our natural being, perhaps we could all relax a little and not be so harsh with each other and ourselves. Moreover, once the admission is made that the feelings themselves brought out into the open without embarrassment, they are much easier to deal with. Suppressed feelings and desires have a way of growing in the dark, just like mushrooms, but they tend to lose their almost preternatural hold on us once we put them in the light of day. Preachers routinely and for thousands of years have taken nature to be sinful. Western culture definitely assigns passion to the dark side, the night side, the female side of life. The side that is opposed to the light of reason, the cold, hard facts of rationality that is ruled by the day and the male sky god. But when you pull all of nature over onto the side of sin, you degrade the most deepest and most fundamental parts of what we are as living creatures and deny the importance of millions of years of evolutionary biology. Our behavior matters, of course, and I'm not advocating or justifying rampant infidelity or wackiness just because we are hardwired for romantic love and all of the feelings and desires that go with it. But I do think our ancestors and our Western religions got it totally wrong. I think that the world being split into male and female With romantic love and sexual reproduction, however those drives and desires may manifest in any individual, I think it creates most of the pure joy and happiness we experience in life. In fact, I would go so far as to suggest that when we accuse a young man or a young woman of being superficial because they are attracted to somebody because that person is beautiful or sexy, we've got it backwards. There's nothing superficial about it. Rather, such attraction is one of the most deeply rooted aspects of our natural existence. It is not only not sinful, it is a part of the very essence of the inherent meaning of our lives. Let me conclude by reaffirming that Willow was absolutely right when she told Buffy, "Love makes you do the wacky." We understand why this is so just a little better now than our mothers and fathers and their mothers and fathers did, but the feelings, the desires, the power of love remain undiluted and are eternally ours. No matter the cultural spin we put on them, love, sex, and reproduction are simply fundamental to us and our beings. We truly are born to love. It is our birthright, our purpose, our meaning, and our glory. Amen and amen.